still remembers fire. Grass remembers rain. Every scar tells a story carved out of pain. If you go digging, son, best mind what you find. The truth.
Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I'm Jerry Wayne Longmire, and y'all, presumably, still y'all. All are welcome here in the Church of Eternal Combustion. We just ask that you show up with an open heart. Hope everybody is doing all right today. Let me get my timer set here. All righty. Hope everybody is making it through like Teflon, baby. It is, it's been a busy few days around here at the house. And trying to decide some things and deal with some things left over from last year. You know, that sort of thing. It's Saturday here. It's about 5 o'clock in the p.m. I'm going to have myself a little cold beer because I'm in the mood for it. And not a big beer drinker, but I do like a Coors every now and then. So, cheers. Here's to you. Whoo, like drinking a loaf of bread. It is Saturday here at the Wrecking Yard. Nice little breezy day. I don't know what that thermometer. The thermometer's pretty accurate today. It's about 60 out there. It's a little cold for my taste. Yeah, I know you guys like, oh, you Southerners. You can't, you know, it's cold and wet here. I don't care for it. Don't care for it. Been doing some, guess you couldn't call it spring cleaning, New Year cleaning. Going through some things. We went through my office, redid my office, got rid of a bunch of stuff. Then we organized a bunch of stuff we had in storage and also got rid of some things there. Freed up some space in the house. Freed up some space in my mind. Sometimes you got to do it. You got to declutter a little. I'm no clean freak, you know. Some of you guys have super organized shops. That's not me. My shit's always a mess. But every once in a while, it gets to be too much for even my brain, and I have to do something before I snap. And that's what happened in my office. I just had so much crap piled up in there. Just a little bit of this I'm working on here, a little bit of that I'm working on here. And it got to be where I would go sit down in my office and go to work on editing something or putting something together for you guys to enjoy. And I would just be irritated just being in there. And so I knew, I was like, oh, okay, we're getting to the point where you got to do something about this. So went through the office, got to hang some of my pictures finally, my Tom Petty post artwork and stuff like that. So it was kind of cool. And then as you can see, there's crap strode out here in the record yard. I don't know what I'm going to do with that big giant foam sign, but I kind of like it. It's from when I was doing meet and greets for the World of Outlaws. And this is cool. So my good friend David, y'all know David, was at a hot rod swap meet or something, and he saw that and he got that for me. Yeah, look at that. It's pretty cool. Somebody had to figure out a way to hang it or put it. I thought it'd be real fun during Diwali time, during story time in Diwali Bottoms, you know. Like an old school radio show. On air, baby. On air. Yeah, a little chilly. Not too bad. I started moving some stuff around the shop. Cleaned some shop out. Been doing some work in the yard. Just decluttering a little bit. Again, it's a good time to do that at the beginning of the year. Kind of get that shit out of your system, you know? You just, there used to be some old wives' tale, some shit like that, where you, you know, when you clean up at the beginning of the year, you sweep all that dirt right out the door on the ground, and then it don't come back, or, I don't know, you sweeping out last year's bullshit, that kind of thing. I've been trying to decide if I was going to, I need to let my good buddy Bill know if I'm going to do the Christmas tour again this year. And I've sort of been wrestling with that decision. He was wanting to know by the January 15th so they could start booking dates. But honestly, my year's getting pretty hectic on its own. I've got so much crap coming down the pipes. You know, stuff I can't really articulate yet because it's not set in stone, but it's on the way. Things I'll be excited to share with you guys as soon as they come to fruition. I'm one of those, I like to count my eggs before they hatch, but by God, these eggs are cracking. All right, they're cracking and they're moving around. And I'm getting just about the point where I can count these some 50s, you know. And stuff, of course, I'll probably share here first because you guys are my people. This is where I come for this sort of thing. We're going to talk some shit out today, actually. Some stuff I'm going through professionally. And hell, maybe some of y'all can throw me some good advice back, you know. Because, I mean, I'm okay where I'm at, but I'm just, we'll get into it. I don't think I'm going to go back and do the Christmas tour this year. Just don't think it's going to. The biggest thing is I don't want to miss out on anything with my kids. They're teenagers, 13 and 15. I figured the next two Christmases might be some of the last Christmases full of wonder. You know what I mean? Like full of us all together. And you know, if there's more than that, great. But I know for sure that we're running the clock out at this point. It's just all there is to it. We're running the clock out, and I don't want to waste next year being away from them. Doing a show that I'm not 100% sure completely fits me anymore either. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I've enjoyed doing the show, enjoyed doing it, but it's, I think I'm ready to spread my wings and do something more my style for Christmas. And so I think what I'm going to do is, I really enjoyed doing the work with Poncho Claus over the Christmas season. And he's invited me to be a bigger part of it next year. And I think I'm going to take him up on that and spend a little more of my Christmas season next year doing for others. And don't applaud me for that. I'm doing it for selfish reasons because it makes me feel good. I'm not doing it out of some great concern for the community. I do have great concern for the community. That's why I did it to begin with. But I ain't gonna lie. Makes me feel good to do it. Makes me feel good to be a part of it. So I can't say it's all, you know, I have to admit that that's a selfish thing, that I enjoyed that feeling. And so I'm going to do more of that next year. And I think I'm going to book a Christmas show here that I'm going to build and design. It's going to be my Christmas show. A little more eclectic mix of music and performers, and just something that feels a little more me. I think. I don't know. I got to call Bill and talk to him. But that's where my head is at right now. It's one of those things, you know. It's not something you figure out overnight. But when people are waiting on you for answers, I like to be early rather than at the last minute, because I don't want them taking the last minute one way or another, and then me blow the lid off the thing or unblow the lid off the thing. And that's not to say that I'm so full of conceit that I believe it wouldn't go on without me. I personally think that's exactly If I don't do it, I think he should replace me and go on. But he mentioned, yeah. Anyways, we'll see. We were going to, we were planning on taking, so they're re-showing the movie Labyrinth. I don't know if y'all remember that movie. It's one of my favorite movies from when I was a kid. I wasn't a David Bowie nut yet, but that movie probably solidified it. You know, probably pointed me in the direction. I love the music in that movie. I'm a Jim Henson fan. I think the creatures in that movie are some of the most original I've ever seen. I'm not a, what was the other one that came out? Never Ending Stories. I maybe seen that movie once or twice. And I think I was already a little too old when I saw it that it didn't really get my attention. I didn't cry when the horse drowned. I didn't have big feelings about the Bog of Sadness or whatever it was, the Swamp of Sadness. But the Bog of Eternal Stench, that one worried me. That one worried me. So we were gonna take the kids to go see it in the theater, but the kids don't really want to go. My kids aren't movie theater kids. I don't blame them. I'm not a movie theater guy. It kind of sounded like fun to me, but you know what sounds like more fun? Is burning a J on the porch and then going in and watching it on Netflix on my own couch with my own snacks and my own drinks and my own people and not having to deal with other people. That sounds way, way cool to me. Like a way cool way to watch Labyrinth. So we've decided to do that, do a movie night at home rather than fight the crowds. It was looking like the shows are pretty sold, pretty tight. So I was like, I mean, it's packed in with a bunch of people. It's fine if it's just me and Rach, but my younger son is, you know, it's a different experience. Him being autistic, we have to. It's a trickier thing. That's why we do a lot of things during the week when everybody else is working, because it's a little less crowds, less people, that kind of thing. I am over the moon about the Nacogdoches show I got coming up. And I urge you, if you are a fan in East Texas and do like watching my stand-up or are interested in coming to one of my stand-up shows, please get yourself tickets to this one. For one, the theater that we're working with, we were able to make some really affordable tickets, cheaper tickets than we normally do. Two, we dropped the tickets for sale a day ago. Well, by the time y'all see this, it'd be 2 days ago. But they're already at 52 tickets sold this morning. The place only holds like 180 people. So I have a feeling we're going to sell this show out. But we're putting the schedule together right now, and we got a lot of things happening, especially because of the book and travel because of the book and some other things I've been invited to be a part of, some interviews and stuff like that, that might be my only East Texas show in 2026 is the show in Nacogdoches coming in February. And I can't remember what the date is in February, but I'll put it in the comments and pin a link to my link tree. That's where you can get tickets. And it's going to be a killer show. Only other two Texas shows I'm even looking at right now is I'm probably going to do one in Walnut Springs with John Clay Wolf and those guys again. We hadn't set a date for it yet, but we've been talking about it. And I'm coming to Austin. In March 6th, I'm coming to Austin, Texas. I'm headlining the Vulcan Gas Company. So I'm pretty psyched about that. But I just cannot believe how many tickets were already sold for that Nacogdoches show. Daddy needs us. I would like a sellout in Nacogdoches. That would be real nice. Also coming up towards the end of the episode, we got Dwali Bottoms, Texas, episode 2. I'm excited about that. We're going to talk a little bit about that. This little thing I'm doing. You know, I came from the blue collar world. I was raised in the blue collar world. I spent most of my life working in the blue collar world. And the thing, I guess the thing I'm used to when it comes to feedback and results are what I would call auditable concepts. Well, when you get feedback on a blue-collar job site, it may be rough and harsh, but they're usually telling you what you did wrong or how you need to fix it. And we've had a number of people review the book, The Wrecking Yard, that I've written. And we've gotten some great feedback, some very specific feedback from a lot of these people. But when you're working with a publisher and stuff, there's a lot of people that have to give you feedback before everything gets done. And one of the people involved did not give I'm all for feedback, even if it's cut this, do this, do this. But they come back and, you know, one of their first notes, their notes were just very vague. Like, I was reading the book and I kept thinking Papaw was his dad. And that doesn't even make sense to me because the very first chapter is all about my father. And Papaw is mentioned alongside that chapter. Now, this person's not from the South. They've never heard the term Papaw before. And there's a lot of different ways to spell it. I spell it P-A-P-A-W. Some people spell it P-A-W-P-A-W. But they come from a place where people are grandfather or grandpa or whatever the shit they say in other places. And so I don't know, maybe I do need to put something in that first chapter and explain what a pawpaw is. I don't know. It feels trite, but I mean, if it's going to unconfuse people, I guess it's maybe necessary to do, but it does feel trite and kind of silly to explain something like that. I don't do well with vague feedback. I don't do well with, I get off in my own head about it is the problem. I'm not mad at this guy. I don't have any personal feelings towards this guy at all, one way or another, about this situation. I know. But I did find out that this person isn't finished reading the book. And I really struggle with somebody offering feedback on something they haven't finished yet or haven't done or completed themselves yet. That's feedback from a place of ignorance, a little bit, you know. If you haven't read the whole project, you haven't gone through the whole project, you hadn't understood the whole project, it's hard to give feedback on a project if you don't know what's going on. You know, that one's a little bit of a struggle for me. I don't often myself offer feedback or advice to people on things I'm ignorant about, things that I don't fully understand. You know, you see it all the time on the internet. You got anybody post a video of them welding or something, and then there'll be 200 comments, guys telling them everything they're doing wrong, whatever they're doing, not knowing the context, what they're welding it for, what they're trying to create, what they're trying to do. Granted, I know there's some simple rules that should be followed, and you can usually tell good welding from bad welding from watching, but it's the same thing. Somebody will pour some concrete, and there are the 600 experts will show up that have never done the job in their life. Now, you can tell when the people actually have some experience because they speak from a place of experience. But generally, they also offer the fact that they're ignorant to the context, the intelligent people. But there's always those 100-something comments that people don't know what they're talking about offering. That's a wild concept to me. Just coming from, I guess, the upbringing and raising I was brought with, you know, if you said something stupid on a job site that was from a point of ignorance, everybody knew what they were talking about was going to turn around and correct you real damn quick. But when people don't have anything to answer them back, boy, it's like they get more encouraged. You know, the literary world and the blue-collar world, very, very different. Granted, I know I'm a newbie in this world, whereas I come from this world with some knowledge, some experience, but some of it's a little baffling to me. What it's really shown me is that what I've really noticed lately is I grew up with physical bullies. I grew up with bullies who bullied by might, who bullied by physical strength. But what it's opened my eyes to is how many people are walking around trying to be intellectual bullies. And you've seen them before. There are people that are maybe a little more well-read than you. Maybe they went to college. They got a degree backing up what they deem as their intellectual superiority. And they will try to bully people that they know maybe not quite as educated, not quite as well-read as they are. And it's just as gross when they do it. It's just as gross either way, you know. When you're trying to manipulate somebody by strength, whether it's strength of intellect or strength of might, you're being a dickhead. You know, there's oftentimes I'll get in an argument with somebody that I realize is not intellectually able to handle their side of the argument. I usually back off because I don't take any pleasure in that. I'm not interested in that. You know, ignorance is just not knowing. But I sometimes think stupidity is knowing that you don't know and still speaking as if you do anyways. You know, I know I am wholly ignorant to a whole lot of things in this world. A whole lot of subjects, a whole lot of ideas, a whole lot of beliefs, a whole lot of reading. I consider myself pretty well read, but I do know there's a lot about this world I don't know about. I try to speak on the things I do know about, or I feel like I know about, based on knowledge. And I don't often offer a lot of stuff outside of my scope of knowledge. Yeah, just like I came to you guys, ask y'all what to do about my plant situation up in the front and the trees and stuff. You know, that kind of stuff is outside of my world of knowledge. It's not stuff I was heavily taught growing up. It's not stuff I was around anybody enough to pick up a whole lot of. I know a little bit about trees from my father-in-law, stuff he taught me, but I would never dare to try to tell a tree man how to come in here and do his job or tell him to do what I thought he should do. I don't think it's a strong way to operate. But you see a lot of people that try to be intellectual bullies on the internet. And a lot of it is just based on maybe they have a degree or they've read certain things and they feel like their understanding is the only understanding. I've seen preachers do it too. I've seen preachers do it with people because they know the word well enough that they know how to manipulate it and to say what they need it to say. And I've seen them bully people that way. When people have honest, open questions about God, somebody told me once, they're like, you ought to preach, man. You ought to preach. And I'm like, no, look, I know the boundaries of my hypocrisy. And I don't want to preach because I have too many questions. I have too many questions about the word. I have too many questions about my belief. I have too many questions about faith that I would never deem to put myself in a position to guide others in their faith and guide others in their questions. I think a lot of them do. I think if you read about Mother Teresa, towards the end of her life, she didn't believe in God anymore. She wrote about it extensively, that her faith had diminished. If somebody is pious and so entranced with goodwill and doing good things and the mission can get that confused later in life, you can't convince me that some of these guys out here shucking and jiving on a stage in a church somewhere aren't questioning their beliefs when they walk out them doors, aren't questioning their beliefs when they're tempted to live outside of the code of that life. You can't convince me of that. I was kind of thinking about different kind of teachers. You know, I did my first story last week, my Diwali Bottoms episode one story, and I'm not crapping on the person that gave me this comment. I promise you I'm not. But I had exactly two pieces of feedback in the chat after I read the story. One person said, "That was awesome, man," which, thank you. That's cool. Not a lot to work with there, though, as far as feedback. I appreciate the compliment. But then another one said, "I don't particularly care for stories like that." And that one kept me up at night because I'm like, stories like what? Stories like about a dude getting killed? Stories with heavy prose? Stories with a lot of scene? What stories like what? What part? Oh, I drove myself crazy into the wee hours of the evening trying to figure out what the hell that meant. And I'm not crapping on the dude. I appreciate feedback. And not everything I do is going to be for everybody. I'm cognizant. I'm aware of that. I'm in very much a phase right now where I am making the things I want to make. And I know not everybody's going to like the lanes I'm choosing. These stories are allowing me the freedom to do something different that I haven't been able to step out and do before. And I recognize that some folks are not going to be into it. It's not like, you know, when I was doing the weatherman character, Willard, I didn't 100% believe in the character. And I didn't have an arc, and I didn't know everything I wanted to do with it. And Wendell Williams, sorry, not Willard. It was an abstract thought that I pushed a little bit, and I pushed it a little bit too hard without having a clear direction for it. And I got a lot of rough feedback on it, and I got defensive about it, and I'm aware I got defensive about it. But this is not stuff that I feel defensive about. These are things that I'm just making because I want to make them. I want to do some different things with this podcast. I couldn't possibly continue to do a story about a car every week because I'm going to run out of cars. So I'm at a point where I need to pepper those in from time to time when I feel it on my heart that one of them's touched me in some kind of way that I want to talk about it. And I'm going to revisit some of the older cars. But that was the first part of the experiment. Where we're at now is a different place, where I try and come and speak to you guys every week about things that actually affect me and things that maybe affect you too. And just tell some of the lessons I've learned. But writing these stories gives me a place to tell the stories I can't tell. Because I got a million stories I can't tell because it would hurt somebody or it would do further damage to somebody who's already been damaged enough. But there's stories that ought to be told some kind of way. Stories that there's a reason they ought to be told. And this gives me the freedom to do that in a different platform, in a different way. To take those stories and make them not about whatever person they affected, but about the sum total of what the story is. I was thinking about different teachers I've had in my life. I've had a number of teachers that affected me in no small way, you know, all the way back to high school, you know. I mentioned a teacher in the intro to my book. I mentioned my fourth grade teacher and speak a little bit about Miss Lewis, a teacher that affected me in some kind of way. Not like, oh, this changed everything about my life kind of way, but like, oh, You know, it's like I used to tell you guys all the time, the words you say to people stick with them. Well, it was some words she said to me that stuck with me as a young kid. And they kept bouncing around up here in the old snake nest until they took hold in some way that made me think certain things. That's what I mean. The teachers like that, the teachers that grab a hold of you, show you different teaching methods. I've talked to y'all a little bit about Mr. Bland in high school, how much his opinion weighed on my mind. Mr. Dias, my theater teacher, somebody was a great teacher to me. And then most of the rest of my teachers came from work, came from being a grown man out in the world doing things, or at least somebody that thought he was a grown man out in the world doing things. And some of them are harsh lessons. Charlie Luden whooped my ass outside a bar in Milwaukee. Taught me a lot that night. We remained friends up until his passing afterwards, but learned a hard lesson in Milwaukee one night about friends that stick by you and friends that don't, and when it's okay to maybe walk away and not get yourself off in something stupid. Took me a while to learn that lesson, but he taught me the first part that night. Guys that taught me different skills, trades. Told you, I really want to do an episode about Big Mike Vargas, my friend Steve's dad, who taught me a lot of what I know about construction. That man really taught me. I was thinking in particular about being in the trades. You know what it was? I was having an argument with somebody about a college degree. And I'm not one of those people that looks down on a college degree. I know a lot of blue-collar guys tend to shun it. You know, like, well, you ain't learned nothing, no college, you know. You're going to learn books and papers. You ain't going to learn nothing about doing nothing, you know. And that was always the thing when the engineer showed up and job. Well, engineers don't know nothing because they ain't out here doing it. And I think that's harmful, too, to always look at it. I think there's a need for both. There's a need for schooling. There's a need for hands-on education. Both of them, I feel like, have their levels of importance. Now, I think you can get schooling lots of different ways. I don't think you necessarily have to go to a university. I think with the things available to us nowadays, a man, woman can teach themselves just about whatever they need to teach themselves. Now, granted, you're not going to go teach yourself how to be a surgeon without going through medical school, but you might be able to teach yourself how to sew up a wound in case you're ever in a shitty situation. I had two men teach me how to do concrete. Two men. Other men taught me stuff along the way. But me and this person was having an argument about this, and they were like, well, I invested all this money in my education. And I was like, well, you seem to think I didn't invest anything in my education, which is not the case. A blue-collar education is an investment of time. It's an investment of flesh. It's an investment of wear on your body. But not only that, like when I owned my little company, I wanted to start learning how to do concrete and stuff. I went and hired a good concrete man, and I paid that man to teach me how to do concrete. He came and worked for me. He done jobs for me, but I was hands-on right there with him, paying him for an education, paying him his value of what he had collected up here. I was paying for that. I don't know how much money I put into that education, but I know it was considerable. I hired two different men, both of them very skilled at their trade, both from different facets of concrete work. One man, Dave had worked for Dart in Dallas in the city, and he had done major concrete projects all over the place. Everything from pouring curbs to pouring sewers to pouring parking garages. The man had done a lot of different things. He'd been a finisher, been a frame setter. All that. He'd done a little bit of all of it, from breakout to repour. The other man was my good friend, Jesus. Now, Jesus come from South California. Jesus had been doing concrete since he was 12 years old. He was in his 40s when I met him. Jesus grew up doing residential, small properties, stuff like that, pouring pads, pouring curbs, parking blocks, pouring lanes, basketball goal, all the little stuff, tear outs. But I wanted to know a little bit about all of it because I was kind of in the middle of some growth for my company, and it looked like I was going to get offered the opportunity to do different things. Now, Dave was not my type of teacher. I didn't agree with Dave on a lot of things, but I didn't have the knowledge to argue with Dave because I didn't know enough about what I was talking about. But Dave wanted to overpour everything. Everything needed to be thicker and bigger. Dave wasn't a big fan of rebar and reinforcement for whatever reason. But Dave wanted to pour everything bigger and thicker, but Dave also wanted to talk about it all the time. Dave wanted to rattle in my ear about what I needed to do and why I needed to do it. Dave wanted to tell me how to do things. But Dave didn't actually want to teach me how to do things. When I would try to get involved in the project, Dave was like, well, no, you're just going to slow me down. Just kind of watch from over there what I'm doing. That's a hard way for me to learn. I learn better when I put my hands on something, especially if it's a physical skill. I learn better from doing. But I was still buying my education. Now, Dave didn't end up working for me for a very long time, maybe 3 or 4 months. Dave had a little bit of a drinking problem. And when I say a little bit, I mean a lot bit. And it got to a point where Dave was drunk on my job sites and I had to make a decision and cut Dave loose. But he was going through something. He had just gotten to a point where I basically got a call from a customer one day that he had fallen off the ladder 2 or 3 times and he was bleeding everywhere. And I got over there and lo and behold, I found a little brown sack with a bottle of gin in it that was about half gone. And Dave was struggling. I had to cut Dave loose. Couldn't have somebody on the job site causing me problems like that, you know. Can't have your customers wondering why your guy's drunk on the job site. He's bleeding all over. And the blood on that porch looked like Dave got in a fight with a damn lynx from a Jerry Clower store. There was so much blood on that thing where he had cut himself a couple times, falling down off his ladder. Jesus was a better teacher for me. Jesus come in here and he taught me about why rebar was necessary and where it was necessary. Taught me about different types of reinforcement, using mesh, using different things for different applications. Taught me the best way to use a jackhammer. But not by telling me. Jesus, we'll go out there. I said, we got to do this bust out. We got to bust all this out. I rented a jackhammer. Here's a jackhammer. And Jesus go, okay, bring the jackhammer over here. And Jesus was standing right there with me. And he's like, all right, you want to break it in these 4 spots right here. And you want to go back and forth working these 4 spots until you get a fully formed crack across. Why am I doing that, Jesus? He said, well, make it easier for us to pick up. We got a bunch of small pieces, we got to shovel it. But if we got decent sized pieces, we can pick them up and throw them in the bin. It's just simple stuff like that. Stuff that if you don't do it, you don't know to think about that. Jesus kept grinder fresh. So when we got into reinforcement, he'd reach down off in there that grinder, cut that reinforcement, that rebar, and we'd get this good old chunk of concrete out of our bust out. Jesus knew that we needed to keep clean concrete free from reinforced concrete because that clean concrete we could take over to the crusher and they'll crush it down for driveways and stuff. And that's one way to get rid of it. It's hard to get rid of concrete. It's got reinforcement in it. Nobody wants to screw with it. So you got to find a dump. And that's more money you got to spend towing that, loading that, and taking that somewhere to be disposed of. Jesus taught me the practicalities of concrete, of how long finishing actually takes, how it's a timing game, he would teach me how to aerate the concrete, how to poor retaining walls. But the way he taught me was by showing me his knowledge right there on the spot and walking me through it while I did it. And I learned so much more from him in an even shorter period of time, enough that I was out doing successful concrete jobs and making pretty good money on them. That was because of Hayes' teaching. I paid for it, but it was money well spent. Some of the money I spent on Dave was not, it's not money well spent. But regardless, at the end of the day, I bought my education. I paid for it with my blood, my sweat, my tears, my physical exertions. I paid for it with money. So I think there's a real disconnect from the blue-collar world and the academic world in that respect, when there shouldn't be. We should both be able to look at the situation and realize we're both paying for our education and we're both doing things the other can't necessarily do. And we need to work together. There's a great James Lee Burke line. It's in a book called Into the Electric Mist. And there's a guy that's not from the area of South Louisiana, and he's there. And these cops, these local beat sheriff deputies, are giving him the business. Oh, the mosquitoes out here are so big, they'll haul you off, that kind of stuff. Dave Robichaux says, they're trying to make fun of your lack of knowledge about a place you've never been before because it makes them feel superior. And he in that short sentence, he explained how bullying works in every aspect. And I always thought that was really brilliant. But there's different ways to learn. There's different types of teachers out there. You have to find the teachers that resound with you. Some people learn a lot from listening to a man talk. Some people learn a lot from being told how to do something. Some people learn better from reading a book about how to do something. But I submit that until you've done something, you don't have a lot of knowledge about it. I say every once in a while you hear somebody who's not a parent give parenting advice, and that one always tickles me. If you hadn't been a parent, you probably should just back out of that conversation. I hear people, you know, on the internet give advice about a great number of things that I'm not 100% sure any of them really know what they're talking about. I made a joke one time about YJ having death wobble, and of course all these guys who read Jeep forums and have been coached by the Jeep Club showed up to, oh, there's a leaf spring suspension, they don't get the death wobble. Let me tell you something, brother, you put 200,000 miles on anything, you can get some death wobble out of it. I don't care what kind of suspension it's got. And if you worked on enough shit, you'd know that. Anyways, let's wrap it up here. Let's do a little story time. Let's return to Diwali Bottoms, Texas. And I'm going to turn my fancy little light. Look here. Boom, on air. Not you can see it behind my big head. Let's go back to Diwali Bottoms, Texas. The sun was just beginning to peek through the asymmetrical boughs of the loblolly pines on the east bank of Caney Creek when the ragged Ford F4 lurched to a stop. It was a new cut site, but the acrid, sour odor from the wet pulpwood cut the day before blanketed the creek bank, even in crisp February air. Danny was barking before he even shut the engine off. Daylight's burning, boys. His voice full of gravel, half muffled from the walnut-sized plug of chew he was shoving between his lip and yellowed teeth, with the remaining three fingers on his right hand. His pinky and ring finger had been sacrificed long ago in this very creek bottom to the gods of commerce. None of the crew knew how long Danny had been cutting pulpwood, but he had the trucks and equipment, worn in age, but still out of most of them's reach, and he paid good money a cord. His stringy gray hair was tied up with an ink-stained rubber band, likely off the newspaper. Counterculture hadn't reached Diwali by 1966. His long hair was a result of a fella not bothering to cut it. He had plenty of money, but polite society wasn't much interested in him. And truth be known, he appreciated the lack of interest. Preferred the company of men with blistered hands and a tougher-than-barbed-wire, fire-headed old woman that looked after the working ladies who plied their trade on the edge of town and a group of old kudzu-enshrined trailers behind the mill property. Carl Sr. must have been dozing on the way out to the site. He woke to Danny, or Mr. Ware, as he called him, retching across the cab to pop him on the shoulder. "Carl, you gonna sleep all day or go make us some money? I told you not to marry no pretty woman. She'd keep you up all night." Carl grinned at the lewd joke he had heard once a week for the last 8 years while he stepped out of the cab. Might be something to it, though. Some sleep had been sacrificed after Carl Jr. went to bed the night before. She had slid under the covers with a wispy trail of jasmine following her. Her high-dollar perfume she only used for special occasions. He had bought her in Dallas on the only trip they had ever taken a few years back. Afterwards, in the still, she had laid her head against his, her breathing still finding its stride, her voice barely a whisper. "I went to the doctor in Kilgore yesterday. You're going to be a daddy again, sugar." He had held her long after she succumbed to the vigors of the day and listened to a pump jack screech its song of greed and need. The tank housing on his worn McCulloch 410, once white, resembled nicotine-stained ivory from years of spilled fuel. Most of the red paint on the body chipped and faded from felling and bucking pine from one end of East Texas to the other. Despite its appearance, with just one pull, it'd be vibrating in his hand like a wasp in a coffee can. Carl stepped down to the cut he had worked yesterday, the sharp two-stroke exhaust cutting through the pine resin in the air. The first tree notched before Miff's men would have had their saw started. Carl's hands knew the work and could perform without much input from him if needed. The back cut is just a steady pull, no bogging, the chain just eating through the soft pine until the kerf opens just enough for some daylight to sneak through. He pulls the saw from the cut while the pine talks to him like an old friend, cracking and popping as he hollers, "Tree!" and steps back to listen to the upper boughs tear through the sun-dappled canopy before slamming into the ground, hard enough to ripple the creek water and make his kneecaps itch. 7 hours of two-stroke scream and 25 felled and buck trees later, Carl pulled the choke until the McCulloch fell silent, the engine casing ticking as it cooled. The loaders were cleaning Carl's cut, the flatbed Ford tractor chuffing slowly under load as they drugged the logs down from the timber-scarred skid trail. He sat for a minute on a stump and pulled the lunch he had packed in the dark that morning from his work bag. The sharp mustard on the bologna woke up his pine and vibration-dulled senses. He was a cord in with two on his mind and didn't waste much time eating before propping the old saw on a short trunk and locking it in place with his knee. He reached in his bag for a round file with electric tape holding the splintered wood handle together. Slowly, he'd file every other tooth until the edges ran clean before rolling the saw and tackling the others. A dull blade could make a man go hungry if you spent the afternoon making powder instead of ripping big clean chips with every revolution of the torquey two-stroke. A dull blade could hurt you, leave you hungry a long time, eating the putty out the windows while you healed. The loader's chains would ring a little as the 8-inch tractor tightened them until the stubborn pine finally gave way to the direction they pulled it. He heard something different as they filed, though. The tractor was lugging harder than normal. The sounds from the tightened chain sounded higher. He just had time to turn his head when the chain snapped with a ferocious pop. The clevis hook bulleted past his face, close enough to peel his cap from his head before embedding itself into a trunk a few feet from where he sat. He couldn't hear anything above his own blood pumping in his ears as the other men hollered and ran towards him. He felt something cold on his cheek and rubbed his hand through a little trickle of blood from his scalp. Danny was shaking him. Carl, you okay? Damn it, boy. You okay? Son of a bitch! Before turning his fearful anger onto the loaders. Next son of a bitch that binds that tractor like that again, I'll kill you myself. Carl stood on legs that threatened to betray him any minute. I'm fine, Mr. Ware. I'm fine. Just graze me. Danny looked at him blankly. Stared back at the clevis lodged in the trunk. Yeah, you're fine, I guess. Danny was still staring at the broken chain, mindlessly rubbing the mangled part of his hand with the good left. He spat as Carl fired up the saw. Burning daylight, Mr. Ware. I gotta get back after it, Carl said hoarsely before stepping away with his growling machine. Danny picked up Carl's cap, handed it to him before turning to walk down the hill to finish excoriating the loaders. Carl poured a little gasoline on his resin-coated hands and wiped the oily residue off before getting in the passenger side of the truck. The 239 flathead was already idling when he stretched his long, tired frame back into the seat. The rest of the crew climbed into the bed with the tools before Danny let off the clutch and pointed the weary Ford back towards town. Most of the crew lived in a ramshackle collection of trailers and kit houses in an area north of the mill right outside of Diwali, affectionately dubbed the Cut. Carl didn't know who named it that, and probably neither did Danny, but the name had stuck. Danny stopped there and dropped the men off with their pay. There was the normal back-and-forth light trash talk that was a daily routine, but Carl couldn't hear none of it. He had a tremor in his right hand that hadn't dissipated since that errant chain had almost mauled him earlier. Images in his head of his wife, Alana, and son crying at what could have become of his visage if he had even survived it. Danny was quiet while the truck squeaked and huffed up the main road. He turned into the quiet neighborhood of shotgun houses that were so neatly lined up you'd imagine they used a ruler to set them. Carl's mama had left him the home when it became clear the strange illness that stole her breath was going to take her to be with her Lord. She had suffered long enough, raised a good man mostly on her own after Carl's daddy died in some faraway place called Saipan when he was just a toddler. Carl Jr. and Tony were playing in the yard on their hands and knees when Danny pulled into the drive and cut the engine. Danny fished some bills out of his pocket to hand to Carl. Throwed some extra on today, just in case you need some aspirin for that headache. Carl grinned in spite of himself. I thought I heard an eagle scream. Danny spit. That's what I get for trying to be nice. I'm just giving you the business, Mr. Ware, Carl shot back as he stepped out the cab. I appreciate it. Nearly lost my best hand today. Hard to make good money without a cutter like you. Danny was looking towards the boys playing when he spoke. Hey, baby boy, he hollered at him. Tony looked up grinning, face beaming. Uncle Danny! Boy, why don't you run home and tell your mama to get a cup of coffee in her? I'll take you out to the Brookshires and get some groceries. The backs of Tony's little bare feet was already present as he shot off towards home. Tony's dad, Danny's little brother, was in Huntsville on an extended vacation after killing a pawn shop owner down in Houston. Tony's mama was determined to drink herself off the planet in protest. Danny tried his best to keep them housed and fed. Carl turned towards his own progeny. Son, go get washed up and we'll see what mama's got for dinner. Carl Jr. chirped out a "yes, sir," before he jumped up on the porch to open the door, the strong breeze ruffling his coppery red hair. Danny fired up the pickup. "See you in the morning, Bubba." Carl stepped up onto the porch and reached for the door while looking back. "See you in the morning." Danny pulled back onto the street with a heavy mind, imagining having to be the one to tell Atlanta that something had happened to Carl. Carl had been 17 when Danny hired him, taught him how to cut. Boy felt like his own sometimes. Carl knew something was wrong the minute he stepped in the house. Atlanta sat at the table in the kitchen, her flower-adorned apron crumpled in front of her, her beautiful face creased and tear-streaked, her green eyes dull, hollowed by some fear that hadn't been named yet. The radio on top of the fridge droned lightly with news of heavy losses in the Ben Din province. Carl started to speak, but caught in his throat when Atlanta pulled the crumpled, damp letter from her apron and smoothed it out on the table. His eyes immediately recognized the typeface in big, bold letters. "Order to report for induction." When their eyes met, he felt like he was trying to swallow wet concrete. By then, they didn't care if he was a family man, and deferment wasn't a word that existed to poor East Texas pulpwood cutters. Tune in next week for more from Diwali Bottoms. Episode 2. In the books. Woo, let's do some testimonials before I get too much further worked up about Mr. Carl. Let's see. These are comments from last week's episode. At MTIHIB90210. What's the name of the James Lee Burke novel that is hard to find? I finally figured it, the novel is called Lay Down My Sword and Shield. Lay Down My Sword and Shield. That's it. It introduced the character Hackberry Holland, which is a he's like a Texas lawyer and a Korean War veteran. And he's a really intense character, and he comes into play later on in some other novels. But I've never got to read Lay Down My Sword and My Shield. That's one I'd like to. One of these days, I'm going to get me a copy of it. I'm going to sit down and read it. This is a long one. Let's go. At Hillbilly High Drinks, JW, I thought long and hard about what you said on the rotten fruit, and damn if it didn't prove true just 2 days later. I had a former friend I had to run off some years ago because of his hard drug problems. We had become incompatible people. I was always kind of worried about him showing back up one day with larceny or spite in his heart. Sorry, I had to break this up. I was prepped for it out of worry. I found out today he got out of prison, recently a broken man. He had a stroke inside and is wheelchair bound now, living in a halfway house in rural Arkansas. 30 years of hard drugs finally caught up to him. It's a sad story. Built one bad decision at a time. Turns out I had no reason to worry about having to shoot him one day. He shot himself with drugs way too many times. Now he probably wishes he was dead, stuck in that chair doing the post-prison Facebook apology tour. I don't expect he'll ever live independently again, much less come stalking around my place. Same old story, I guess. At any rate, he shook himself right out of my tree of worry. All I ever had to do and did was mind my own business. I always hoped he'd do better, but he cast his own mold. Wasn't for lack of trying on my part. Rest in peace, Jeremy. JW, thank you for your sermons, if we want to call them that. You always make me think and laugh and even shed a manly tear now and again. I and the silent many others out there appreciate your efforts week in and week out. Hey, thank you for that. Yeah, Billy. Sorry to hear your ex-friend's story. They don't all turn out good. And one of the things I really liked about your comment was acknowledging that you took no pleasure in that, because I told y'all about the things that happened to the man that caused me so much heartache, but I took no pleasure in those things when they happened to him. His grandsons died in terrible ways, and I took no pleasure in that. It just made me sadder about the dude. I hate hearing what happened to your friend, but some people just, they can't break free. But I'm glad you didn't end up having to sully your soul, feeling like you need to do something about him yourself. I wish I had learned that lesson a little younger, a little earlier myself. At Farvanugan. Farvanugan. I'm super excited for the weekly story time. You have a real poetic way with the language, and I love both Lake Wobegon and Yaknapatawpha County. I always struggle saying that. I think you're on to a winner. Well, time will tell, my friend. Time will tell. But I can tell you, getting the ability to write without any print, just do what I want to do, is very freeing, and I'm enjoying it. And I told you, I got off of that Rick Rubin shit where he's like, you know, you got to make stuff that you like first, and then, you know, the audience comes second. You got to write the stuff that you like first. You got to create the things that you want to create. And I had gotten in a bad habit a few years there of making things that I was worried about what other people thought about them, and making things, you know, almost, you know, people would give me suggestions. I'd be like, well, maybe I should do that, or maybe I should do that. And people gave me suggestions for the podcast. Well, maybe I should do this or do that. And it's not that feedback's bad. It's just you got to make something you like first before you can expect anybody else to like. And I'm approaching this project very much from that way. So thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed the first one. Hope you enjoyed the second one. All these stories are going to do work to get us to a place. I'm not 100% sure where that place is yet. Somebody last week said, are we going to find out next week who killed Tony? And I said, hell, I don't know if I know who killed Tony yet. Seems like there's a lot of people that wanted to, though. All righty. Hey, I love you guys. This is just my favorite part of the week. I was, you know, when I was thinking about the concrete and I was thinking about some different stuff, I kept thinking about the strength of flexibility. See, I learned concrete from a couple different teachers. One of them believed in bulk, port thick, port heavy. Let the might of sheer strength and weight do the work. And the other one taught me about what you don't see, rebar, wire, the preparatory work before the pour that lets it move just enough so it don't come apart when the ground shifts. Both of them are right, just not for the same reasons. You can see the same thing with bullies. There's the loud ones, the physical ones. Easy to spot. You know when they're coming. But the ones that did a little more damage were the intellectual bully. The ones that didn't hit you, but tried to convince you you were small. Tried to make you stiffen up, dig in, defend every inch of who you are. Both of these aggressors come from a place of inflexibility. One from the belief that might makes right. The other from the belief that what they were taught is right, and no one else has a right to think differently. That's where the That's where the flaw gets exposed. Take a tree. An oak is strong, dense, rigid. Makes a hell of a piece of furniture. Something that'll hold weight for generations. But you put that oak out in a hard wind and it can't move. If it won't give, it snaps. Loud, clean, done. And pine ain't as impressive in the shop. It dents easier. Feels softer in the hand. But it grew up learning how to bend. It sways, it leans. It gives just enough to survive the storm and still be standing there afterward looking like it never fought at all. Concrete is awful similar. On its own, it's strong, but it's brittle. One good shift and the whole damn thing fractures. But you reinforce it, let it flex a little, and now you got something that can take a beating and keep doing its job. That's the lesson I keep relearning. That strength alone ain't enough. Not in life, not in relationships, not when the wind starts pushing from directions you can't control. There's a kind of pride, you know, that says, I won't change, I won't bend, I won't move no damn more. And that feels brave, but standing stiff in the street, flipping your finger at the storm, don't make the wind stop. It just gives it something clean to break off. Quiet strength looks different. It listens, it adjusts, it bends without surrendering. It knows what matters and what ain't worth breaking over. You don't have to give up who you are. You just don't have to be rigid about it. That's part of the journey, you know. You got to learn to be oak where it counts and be pine when the wind comes. Put some rebar underneath those convictions. Let yourself flex enough to stay whole. Because surviving the storm of life is not about proving how strong you are. Regardless how many Facebook memes you read about it, it's about still being here when the storm is gone. Every week I'm rooting for every one of you to make it through every storm that comes your way. I ain't saying you ain't gonna be a little dented and scarred when it's over, but I just wanna see you still standing. I'm JW. I love you. On air. Off air. Coors Banquet. Boy, that'll get you out. Wanna be high up in the clouds. Rain on my mind. Rain on my mind. Ooh, I got to figure out what we're going to do next week. What the hell's going to be happening in Diwali Bottoms? Probably ought to start working on that right now. Love you guys. Thank you for sharing your Sunday with me. Or whenever you listen to this. I hope some of you get to make it out to the Nacogdoches show. It's always my favorite to meet Wrecking Yard people. If you're around the Austin area, I'm going to be in Austin March 6th. Those tickets ain't on sale yet, but I'll let y'all know when they are. But the Nacogdoches tickets are on sale, and they're moving quick. And I couldn't be more over the world about that. Y'all be safety. I'll see you next week.